So, would the Hobby Gamer Group spokesman please come forward?
Reverse order, is it?
I'm trying to surprise people.
Thank you. Surprise, yes.
All right, you have 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Interesting discussion for this group. I guess the first question we have for ourselves is, who are we? It's a question we often ask ourselves, but it's such a wide group, the hobby group, that it really wasn't easy to come up with any single group and say, look, this is what we are and who we do. Are there any answers I give here are the answers that a number of members of our group agreed with, but maybe not everybody, and probably not everyone in the hobbyist community would agree with what I'm going to say. It's only going to be a series of bullet points. It's not a structured discussion at this point, but what I would say is the first question was, should we actually be part of this at all? Do you want us to be part of this? Because there's a number of things that we bring, both negative and positive, as a hobby community. And I'm talking about the UK hobby community, which has certain ramifications, certain implications about the kind of people that you might end up within the institution that you're looking at forming. So the questions of credibility. Does the hobby community bring credibility with it? If so, what does it bring? If you institutionalize the community, and I use that in the sense that you're trying to talk about, you potentially ossify the very thing that the external community might bring. What the hobby community brings is that variety, is a lot of different views, and probably what you don't want to do is to fix it into a particular structure. We had an interesting discussion about the difference between the US hobby community and how that's perceived and what the UK hobby community is. And I think our perception, and it was only a perception from the UK community, is that the US hobbyists tend to have come from within, in many cases, the institutions that you're trying to get them back into. And in many cases, they're resprays, they're people who come from the military, from the CIA. A lot of the UK hobby community doesn't have that same kind of background. Some of them do, but an awful lot of them don't. The thing we thought was probably a good idea is if the institution itself, if there is one, reached out to the hobbyists rather than the hobbyists trying to impose themselves upon the community. So that was the kind of other aspect we were looking at. We did think that we could potentially provide a deniable and expendable resource for the community as a large or for the institution as a large. So what do we bring? What would the hobby community bring? It brings an awful lot of historical knowledge, which I think in a lot of cases a lot of the institutions have lost right now. I look at a lot of the discussions that I had, and historical knowledge is often lacking. We bring a completely different cultural mindset. That's more different than you'd want, but in many cases, by having a completely different mindset, you get a different view. You get some of those views that the enemies that we're trying to tackle have, or certainly a different mindset from the ones that we ourselves have. We also bring an awful lot of tools and techniques and experience of how to simulate things. Some of them may work, some of them may not, but there's an awful lot of them out there, and there's a lot of experience among the hobbyists of designing games and designing structures that probably will be very valuable to the community. And we also bring a degree of impartiality as an outside group. We're not part of the in-group, very definitely not part of the in-group in many cases. The sort of areas that we thought we might be useful are in providing red team support, in providing blue team advice, in being hidden in a black box. A lot of people thought that was probably the best place for us. In providing green input, soft factors, sort of things that, again, that require that degree of impartiality. And in playtesting. If anyone can be guaranteed to break a game system and min-max it out, it's going to be the hobbyists. They will prove your system, your game, works or doesn't work before you even bring it in front of the players or the stakeholders. We also bring a lot of facilitation and subject matter expertise to a game. I think a lot of the people that act as control in the mega game on day one were people who had a lot of hobby gaming facilitation and expertise, and that was one of the things that helped make that work. That's it. Red card held up. I'm going to stop right there. I don't go beyond that.
You have a minute left.
No, that's fine. You hold a red card up, I'm going to stop. Okay. I'm institutionalized that much. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Will the industry representative please come up? Industry? Sorry, the accent might throw me off.
Okay, thanks for Rob for actually pointing out some of the caveats on my feedback as well, in that industry is quite a diverse set of people. And there's at least two things that I think we were looking at as industry. One is we sell into the public sector, so that's one way that you can think of industry, is people who are trying to sell more gaming into the public sector. The other one is industry using board gaming, and we just flowed between those two quite interchangeably. So how do you use board gaming for business to sell to industry, and how do you sell it into the military? As with Rob, a number of just bullet points here, which I hope have sort of picked up a number of the things at least that we discussed. First one of the things you can do potentially in an organisation is have a wargaming centre of excellence. That might be a way of trying to institutionalise wargaming, but also building capacity, because if you've got that centre of excellence, it's a way that people can have a career that moves into it and moves back out into the rest of the business or the organisation with that knowledge about wargaming, which means they might want to do it as a customer or might be able to do it as a wargame designer themselves. It all requires top level buy-in. We all agreed with that. Then the question is, well, how do you get it? That's a little bit harder. It was pointed out that sometimes with a business, if it has a big failure, that's quite a good way for it to reevaluate what it's doing, and that can lead to suggestions of new ideas, creative thinking, and that creative thinking can bring in things like wargaming. So the other one is obviously demonstrating the benefits. How do you do that? You have to be able to get in there and talk to the top people. A lot of discussion around the name. Does wargaming as a name help or hinder? And there was no answer to that. Sometimes it can be really good. People outside, it suggested banks in particular, like the idea of wargaming. Other organisations don't want to call it wargaming. It may be scenario evaluation, it could be scenario-based planning, could be serious games. But there was no obvious decision that we should change the name or that we should keep the name. It's use the right name for your customer. Question about whether or not we need to sell wargaming as a service. Does it go down better if it's part of a larger offering that you've got to someone and you can sort of bring wargaming in when you're saying, well, I can do this for you. And part of that is you do some wargaming. Again, you might not call it wargaming. It could also be a very simple thing based perhaps on just being a bit more than red teaming. So if you can already do red teaming, you could do a little bit more. And then if they bite on that, you can then sell them the much larger scale wargaming. We're wondering what it is that we in the room were bringing. And I think we agreed that mostly in industry, there are individuals. There's a lot of individuals who can be sold in. It's harder to get a whole organisation brought in to do wargaming. And I think we can see from this conference that it's quite often sets of individuals people know. So if the capacity is in the individuals, how do we get that into something which can be institutionalised? Well, do we have a professional organisation that brings all those individuals together so they can help everybody else sell in the whole concept? We talked about, do we need a guild? Do we? But again, a little bit with the hobby war gamers, as we decided, if you did too much, it would get very ossified. The main thing, though, is we need to raise a profile. If it's the profile is raised, if the information is out there, that is what is going to encourage people to use it, to institutionalise it, and indeed to potentially get more people doing it.
Thank you. Will the academic representative come up, please?
We had a very good discussion. A broad range of academic and military educational attendees. Very immediately apparent the diversity of experience, that gaming is entirely acceptable and used routinely in areas like economics and so on. In international relations and political science, it's pretty well accepted. In some areas like my own of military history, it's hardly apparent at all. So it's building on the success where that is apparent elsewhere and forging those links and extending that into the areas where it's currently proving more challenging. We're very dependent on individuals, and we talked about what would happen if individuals among us, you know, dropped dead. Would the wargaming continue? And that's really the definition of institutionalization, that there is this feeling that it needs to go on beyond any individual. There are several elements to that, it seems to me. I think this is the core of the issue. One is, how many of us individuals are there to come in and step in and take over and carry the torch forward? And what we thought was, the key is to encourage people to, if you like, come out of the closet, that there are many, many people who are wargamers at hobby experience, but who don't do it in their professional academic lives because they don't feel it's proper to do so. They certainly wouldn't boast of it or even admit it. And I think an absolute key priority is to encourage those individuals, and for that, the key word is connections, the sharing of information, knowing that others are doing it, knowing that others are succeeding in this way. So the conference here, publications, the PAXINS website, all of these sorts of mechanisms to spread experience and to cross-certify Rex Brynan's thought that what will help in our individual struggles, perhaps with our institutions, is if we are praised by people from outside and vice versa. The student experience is very important, and we saw that as not too much of a problem. If the war games are well run, the students don't tend to see them as a waste of time. We've heard one, perhaps not entirely representative student perspective here today, but that illustrates my point. It is important to have trial and error. It is important to recognise when certain game systems fail and to learn from the ones that work better so that we develop that further. It's important to push at this issue of demonstrating objectively the educational value of gaming. It's a very difficult thing to do because so much of it is a qualitative rather than quantifiable area. But in educational journals, for example, the standard is now so high that you have to have some kind of supposedly objective proof. You can't just say, oh, my game worked really well, now publish my article. Plus, we need to think, do we want to go beyond seeing wargaming merely as a means to an end, merely as an educational tool? If we want to suggest that it has analytical value and research value within the academic realm and not just as a means to an end of education, then we actually need to get into substantive journals and not those focusing purely on the educational technique. Libraries are an element here. Certainly my experience has been that libraries are very reluctant to host the paraphernalia of gaming, board games or computer games. Others, interestingly, around the table there said they had better experiences. But if you're going to institutionalize this at all, you need to have the resources there such that the successor can take them over. Using the new technology, using videos, for example, on YouTube to help explain to people how the war games can be played, because as we know, for non-gamers, actually picking this thing up from just reading the theory and the rules is itself an almost insurmountable problem. So using new technology to allow us to expand in that way. So the key word there, very much connections, building on the links that we've established here, and not perhaps pushing too hard at what may be an immovable obstacle, trying to get non-gamers forced in academia, forced to do gaming just because the institution demands it. Rather, make the institutions want to recruit people like ourselves in greater numbers. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Will the Historic Analysis Group please pass under representative board?
Hello. So, as I'm from DSTL, I'm going to start with a caveat. Now, although it was a historical analysis group, pretty much everyone in the group was also from defense, so that's just something to bear in mind. So the main thing that we saw as being a hurdle towards institutionalizing wargaming was the fact that the lack of resources, the lack of money, the lack of time, the lack of people who are available to provide exactly what people need. And when we say that, what we're talking about is creating a culture where it's safe to fail, where we can experiment, where we've got the money and the time, and our customers are willing to let us try new things And if they don't work, they don't work. And if they do work, great, fantastic. One of the things that we also talked about was, do we feel like that our officers are coming out of their respective colleges are ready to fight the next war? We didn't necessarily think that they are ready to fight the next war, or more specifically, that they're not ready for the uncertainty of what the next war might be. And for that, we thought that actually one way to help institutionalize wargaming is to get in early, to talk to the officers when they're junior, to provide them not just with presentations and talking about wargaming, but actually to make them play wargames. And to do that, we need to develop new types of wargames, quick wargames that we can just do in 2 hours and say, what did you think of that? And that they can take away and start developing themselves. Mm-hmm. We need to think of new ways of doing those things. And although senior leader support is really important, the fact of the matter is if you don't get them early, they won't be the senior leaders in the future who'll be making those decisions. And when we're talking about those quick wargames, maybe we also need to think about using historical battles. It is from the historical side of the war. But when I'm talking about historical battles, I'm not talking about Waterloo or Cambrai. We're talking about recent campaigns. We see that there was a lack of wargaming of the campaigns that we just fought, of going through what went wrong and what went right. And we've got people who fought in those wars, and we're not using them as a resource in our wargames. Say, well, actually, what was your experience of this? And teaching the new people coming through, what were the problems in those campaigns? Basically fighting the last campaign to make sure that we don't lose it in the same way, or that making sure that what we thought was the reasons we won were actually the reasons that we won them for. But as part of that, we also thought that this could be a process of lessons identified. So not just creating a new generation, but also informing the current generation of actually what happened. We also need to actually start, in terms of the defense community, needs to start really tapping into all facets of the wargaming community. We have a tendency to focus on the defense side. We don't necessarily go and talk to the hobby gamers that much. And so certainly social networking, it will be an important part of this. But also, actually sharing as much unclassified material as we possibly can. In a similar way that companies share their codes for RSA keys and things like that to make sure that the international community tries to break it, we should be sharing our rules and we should be sharing our sets that we can, so that the community at large can look at them and decide whether actually they think they're fit for purpose. And rather than becoming more insular, become more inclusive. That's all I've got to say.
Thank you. For the military education and training report.
Okay, I'd just like to start my comments off with a big apology to my group, because having said I was going to hand it over to Johan, I then proceeded to bully everyone into my way of thinking. So Johan, I owe you a bottle of wine. We came up with some practical list of things and some ideas. And one of the big things, of course, was we need to start people young. We need to get the idea of wargaming just generally accepted. And one of the things we thought, which was really important, was messaging. So commanders send out their reading lists suggesting books. So why don't we get a game onto the commander's reading list? We need to make sure people are talking about libraries. They need to have accessibility to the appropriate games. They have to be really simple and accessible and usable. And we need to be able to have it so that people can be taught how to run those games very simply. Now, there are initiatives that's hoping to do that. But in addition, we need to make sure that the language is accessible to the people we're trying to teach. So I was discussing with Phil about a cyber game, and I said, what's the mechanism in it? And he said, spell cards. And I knew exactly what he meant, and I spoke to the guys who were designing the game, and spell cards is exactly. Now, of course, being a wargamer, I understand that, but that's exactly the wrong language to use in certain communities. Really, really the wrong language to use. So we need to make sure that we use the appropriate language for the people we're trying to use. Because at the end of the day, we want to have success stories out there as part of our PSYOPs campaign. Because as Phil said earlier this year, this is the game of games. And if we can't war game our way back into getting it accepted, then we should all hang up our hats and go home. So we are doing PSYOPs and we need to address media. Now, one of the things is getting stuff published. Well, that's appropriate. Yeah, okay, we'll get it into the British Army Review. None of the subalterns read British Army Review. You know, how do we get it out there? How do we get it on social media? Mega games used to be about 50 or 60 people until Shut Up and Sit Down attended a mega game and it went viral and Jim had to organise a 400 player game the next time he did it. Those are the sorts of things we're looking for. The other thing we need is to get some evidence, because at the end of the day, we are talking about people who are going to pay money for this. We're going to get this done during working hours. We will need some evidence that it works. Now, I have an idea that if you use a war game, you will teach information about capabilities far more efficiently than any lecture on time and distance and weapon capabilities and stuff like that. You introduce people to the war game, they get an overview about time and space, overview of weapon effects, overview of that sort of thing, much more quickly. And we need to have that sort of evidence that we can teach people faster and better. The other thing we all need is student feedback. If we're going to teach people that are younger people, we have to engage them. So if you don't get a 4.5 or a 5 average on your Likert scale, on your inval at the end of your course, then you're not doing it right. Give up and go home. We need to get the students saying, I want more of this. It's better than the boring presentation in PowerPoint. Oh dear. Because at the end of the day, we want to give people permission. We want them to understand that it's acceptable. We want a champion, a senior officer, to say, yes, I'll put a war game on my reading list. Yes, it's an acceptable thing to do. Because at the end of the day, what we're trying to promote is professional excellence. Not just development, professional excellence. That's what we're trying to get out of war game. Thank you.
The Defence Science Technology.
Okay, so we started off with quite a good little debate around what the question actually meant and trying to get towards some of the sub-questions that you posed as well. And then what we thought we'd try to do is to say, actually, instead of sort of thinking about sort of, you know, how to take forward immediately, what is currently stopping us in institutionalising war gaming and building that capacity? So what are our current constraints? Common with some of the things we've heard already from the other groups, there is this thing about scrutinising, assuring what's the quality of the evidence that's coming out, how do you show that what war games produce are actually producing something that people should sit up and take notice about. So we've heard some of that today and throughout the conference as well. Coupled with that is the idea about peer review. I was just picked up what the hobbyists were saying about being able to expose games to game testing, thinking about drawing some of that historical stuff as well, and engaging the wider community in peer review of guess of output as well as games and new mechanisms as well. And I guess also playing to that is this idea about lack of exposure of gaming as well, so not only amongst the community perhaps where we could expand that peer review, but amongst the senior stakeholders as well. And obviously how we get that engagement is quite key. Well, the other thing stopping us, according to what the group said, is the lack of a professional society. And I'll come on to that on the next slide as well, because that may be a little bit contentious as well. And also trying to get people to understand the serious nature of the gaming as well, about what it can actually produce, and getting back to that sort of assurance and support and evidence piece of thing as well. There is also this idea about we've got at the moment a lack of a body of knowledge that we can't necessarily easily draw upon. So whether that is in terms of output or whether that is in terms of sort of engaging the community and understanding how to build games and actually sort of get them more widely accepted as well. So how do we sort of tap into that community body of knowledge? Obviously we've got things like connections that help, but is there something else that can improve on that as well? Also think about what is it that people are looking for? So we've had quite a sort of diverse set of briefings about seminar games, you know, all sorts of, you know, fully manual games, computerised games and so on. So there is quite a sort of wide variety of sort of mechanisms out there for actually delivering evidence to support decisions, for example. But what is it that people are looking for when they come to us to ask us to do some sort of analysis? They may have an image in mind about what a war game looks like, yeah, and we need to sort of think about how we sort of encompass all sorts of approaches to gaming as well. From the technology point of view, there is a feeling that there's a disconnect between technologists perhaps and war gamers. So if we're looking about doing war games, look at technology options, technology solutions, we perhaps need to sort of engage a little bit more with the technology groups to encourage them to get a little bit more of an understanding of what gaming and those sorts of techniques can do as well. And obviously we need to think about sort of making sure that when we're doing our analysis, we're not making sure we're not playing to people's pet ideas about something. So the last thing was thinking about, if you picture yourself forward a few years, what does success look like? So this is now Nirvana from the S&T Group. Professional Accredited Society was one of the top things that came out. And obviously that immediately raised alarm bells with some that we may alienate whole groups, but perhaps we can deal with that with levels of membership. And that was to try to engage a truly diverse community, yeah, and build up this idea of professionalisation, accreditation sort of things, which will help with the credibility of evidence that comes up as well. And I think someone gave the analogy about engineers having been, you know, accredited early on in their professions and so on. And also it comes down to some of the things we've heard about publications, peer review, getting things into journals and getting the products out there as well. And also I think there's a point about trying to make sure that war games are seen as business as usual. So it's not saying we know there is a schedule coming up, so in 2 years time you've got to get your idea in for that big game that's coming up. How can we make these things happen on a, you know, almost continuous basis, and that people's ideas and thoughts and innovations are getting into a whole stream of different games. I think that was basically it, actually.
Thank you. And last, but certainly not least in my mind, those serving the frontline personnel, military, emergency services, etc.
the reason I jumped in there and decided to tandem the team is because both of our frontline services, with Russell here representing a holistic approach to blue line services, emergency services, etc., and my own being the military.
Matt and I are going to give some observations of both the presentations and what we heard as we walked around through the groups. Hinging off the last comment there, for those who have the blunt end of the consequences of actions not well thought out, I think that's the key element of the discussion that I had opened up about box sets and seminar games, that there was no adjudication and no consequences of actions. That was my primary argument regarding those two. It's not that they don't have value, but quite often, or most often, there are no consequences. There's no adjudication, no consequences of actions in those styles of games. And we as a community need to fix that. As I listened to the presentations and walked around, the key theme that jumped at me, and I'm not going to say that these are completely objective, because he's hit on other themes that I've seen before previous presentations. But the key thing is, as a group, we are concerned about our credibility. And this goes to both the evidence and the education, and also the credibility of our customers. And just as importantly, from Ellie's presentation, the credibility of the participants, who are the most critical element within the game. This goes to the next part about, also related to this evidence, is that I have characterized the wargaming community as a loose tribe of talented amateurs. And this goes both to the discussions about, well, what would happen if certain key individuals disappear, et cetera, and goes into the peer review issues. But quite frankly, a pool of talented amateurs won World War II and gave birth to operations analysis and forgot that they were amateurs and decided that they were professionals. And I think got a little too deep steeped in their own estimate of themselves. The safe to fail was another theme that came out of several groups, not only today, but in past.
the start them young, that was that there's a recurring theme in many presentations, particularly with this next generation, with their electronic devices and other things that some of us have difficulties with. I do not know whether or not those are effective tools to achieve the innovation process that the Deputy Secretary is calling for. I simply don't know. But I would be a fool not to at least pay attention to those, because that's the medium in which to meet that next generation. But they seem open to the idea of playing games, so certainly should play into that. That tool of talent and amateurs and the credibility issue all then goes to the permission to play, which is the key theme from the message that Paul Weber fed into the hands of some of the leadership within the Navy, and I hope we do elsewhere, that this is not going to take off and have the desired effect unless people think there's permission to play. Now, as to the body of knowledge question, my rejoinder to that is there's a vast body of knowledge about wargaming, and it is in the commercial and hobby realm. You go to a historical miniatures gaming society, World War Gaming, and you see the number of home-written rules, homegrown rules that are out there. It's vast. There's a vast body of knowledge, and the competition between those methodologies and techniques is vast, and it's checked by who actually shows up to play the games. So I would say if we say we are professionals and are not interested in what the hobbyists and the commercial area folks are doing and not researching that, I think we're missing out on a lot. In fact, we're missing out on the most of the body knowledge that is out there. So yes, I do challenge the wargaming community. If you are such strategic analysts and you understand that the world is run by human decisions and wargaming is about human decision making, then you should be able to build the game of games. That you should be able to understand the analytic agenda in the United States. I don't know what its equivalent is in the United Kingdom and other places. And you should be able to understand what that process is and game that game and win the game of games. Because unfortunately, as the Deputy Secretary's memo says, we have a serious problem. Our current approaches are not working.
Okay, very good. Well, one thing, just three things I want to comment on. One has already been addressed a little bit. The hobby group said, do you guys want us? And let me second my distinguished commander in saying that yes, the community very much wants the hobby people, the industry people. The name Connections was picked very much on purpose following the BBC series and the book Connections, because that made a very strong case that human progress comes from taking a technique that's been around for years to weave cloth and use it to count the population of the United States, and then use that somewhere else, and that this brings it to us. And computer gaming writ large, not just the wargaming part of it, is now a larger industry than Hollywood in the United States. It generates more gross income annually. Now, where will innovation come from? A global industry that's generating billions and billions of dollars, or the six or eight of us? So a lot of that innovation may be irrelevant, it may not be appropriate to our needs, but the only way we can pick what works and what isn't is by keeping in touch and very much keeping the industry and the hobby folks close to what we're doing. Also, Professor Sabin's comment about library, something that I should think about more. If this is important, we need to be making an archive. And again, going back to the film industry, there are very few histories of the early film industry because everybody thought it was a toy, a pastime. They didn't take films seriously. So a lot of the early films were melted down to get the silver back to make more films. A lot of the movies didn't have a director or didn't have any sorts of credits on it. So people trying to do histories of the early years have a hard time doing it. A lot of brain power has gone into wargaming on both sides of the Atlantic. We need to make sure that that's preserved. And the Connections UK website is a start. Our website's a start. But we really need to make sure we archive all that. And then finally, to kind of second the conclusion on the value of wargaming, there's a series I think showed over here too called MASH, and it could be very funny, it could be very poignant. And in one of the episodes, Hawkeye's history teacher, he felt it was a just war, he volunteered even though he's over the age to be drafted. Hawkeye patched him up the first time and was unable to do so the second. And Hawkeye just couldn't take it anymore and left the operating table. And the commander came out and said, Hawkeye, something you have to understand, there's only two laws in war. One law is that young men are gonna die, and the other law is doctors don't get to change law number one. Now, we can apply that to war game. We can do the most brilliant war games, we can get it accepted everywhere, we can do everything just right, and young men, increasingly young women, are gonna die no matter what we do. But fewer of them will die. Fewer of them will be crippled. Less national treasure will be lost. Peace will be restored more quickly the better we do war gaming. And that's something that I think each and every one of us can accept as a very worthy goal to pursue. So thank you all very much.